plans to have family should really remind each other and themselves of the commitment of the responsibilities of marriage and parenthood, that some way these are natural principles. These are not something that were developed by King James in the first edition of the King James Bible. They were not something that the Greeks developed, or the Egyptians, or the Chinese. Every people in the world has recognized the necessity of preparing a sound foundation for the incarnation of children, that they must have the right beginning, and that enough people giving their children the wrong beginning will end in a world war. Once we have destroyed the faith of the young, it is hard to restore it. And it is hard to protect it in them if we have not protected it in ourselves. Therefore, the very great purpose and reason behind all this is to recognize that the coming in of a better generation is the long-range solution to the present problem. They have got to come in and be treated better. They have got to be come in and inspired more. They've got to come in with a realization that it is better for themselves and all others that honesty and integrity should dominate their conduct. This training comes from the home. Without the home, there is no such training. Comenius, the founder of the public school system many years ago, centuries ago, said definitely that the primary educational system is the home. That the first schooling is at the mother's knee. That all of the later intellectualism must be dominated by the inspiring attitude of parents and the love they have for their children and the love which they wish their children to bestow upon their children in due time. Therefore, as Comenius says, any education that they get before they are 10 years old is by far the most important and the most directive. If it is bad up to then, character is badly wounded. If it is good up to that time, the world will not be able to completely defile it afterwards. So idealism, patience, self-sacrifice, the giving up of personal luxuries for the sake of protecting the family spirit, these are musts in our present civilization. And they are also better for the parents of today, because sometime those parents are going to be older and may demand or need a great deal of help from their own children, only to find that these children don't even remember that they existed. All of this type of thing brings the practical reform of things much deeper than trying to reform the tariff regulations or something of that kind. They're all tied together. But the laws of honesty in physical things would not be necessary if the individual himself was innately honest. And where a nation is strongly religious, even though its teachings may be rather elementary, such a family or such a nation has a much greater problem of survival. And we notice now in many of the socialized states that the rise of religion is strongly marked and must be accepted. It can no longer be simply brushed aside. We are beginning to learn politically that without religion, no nation can be governed. So these things come back again. If it's true of the nation, it's true of the home. If it is true of all, it is true of each. And the problem of building this into our living is of vital and eternal significance. I might point out that in the Greek world, the development of education was somewhat different from what it is now. They didn't have schools like we have, but were more like the Oriental system. They had teachers, but a teacher was someone who was a scholar, who was learned, usually patient, kindly, maybe a little disciplined, and a little severe to those who were unmitigatedly out of line, but the parent took the children to the teacher. Socrates was such a teacher, Diogenes, Plato, Aristotle. They were all teachers, Socrates. All of these teachers had small groups of people. that they tutored. The price of tutoring was very small, but nothing like the initiation fees to a modern university. But for a few cents a day, a teacher gave instruction on the subjects with which he was particularly familiar. All these teachers were bound together by the religion of the state. They were all of them true believers in the divine pattern accepted by the communities in which they lived. But they also were able to interpret. Every one of those great teachers of antiquity who taught arithmetic, for example, were not satisfied to simply talk about adding and subtracting and multiplying and dividing. Before they got through talking about arithmetic, they talked about practically every cosmic mystery that man has come in contact with. They lifted arithmetic immediately into morality and ethics and divinity, and showed finally the importance of mathematics, because God, in creating, created by geometrizing. So geometry was a sacred science. All these things, trigonometry, higher mathematics, physics, medicine, art, literature, were all sacred sciences. And because they were sacred sciences, the teachers gave part of the moral responsibility. If you studied with a disciple of Pythagoras, you came out of this school convinced of the realities of integrity. You were convinced of the greater world of which we are a part. And each student, before he graduated from his local teacher, was already mindful of what might happen to him in a future embodiment. All this is gone. All is now a great curriculum of rather dusty, musty, and no longer very practical facts. We are not able to get an educational system that in any way will compensate for the family grouping. And the only place now where children can receive the basis of a good life is in their own home. And if they are deprived of this by the utter selfishness of their families, then there is a serious moral responsibility descending upon the parents. And the karmic consequences of this neglect should be borne in mind. Because when we are selfish enough to sacrifice the realities of those nearest to us, simply to our own pleasures and comforts, we are already breaking some of the basic laws of universal procedure. So we know that education is coming into a new way of life. New schools are coming up. New educational systems are being developed. And every day in the newspaper, you now see remarks concerning changes in the curricula in order to make it more practical for the person. And now the word practical means moral. It means, again, the rise of integrities. It has been proved definitely that you cannot have integrity unless you inspire it and reward it. It will not come to simply because it's there. It will become because, as a result of it, the individual has the right to make a larger contribution to the common good. All these things are part of the very modern patterns with which we are now concerned. Now, when you take a young couple today and you put them up with the family and all the relatives, friends, and etc., and perform the marriage ceremony for them, you nearly always do feel that there is a sincerity there. The exception, of course, to this is what might be termed the competitive wedding. Now, a competitive wedding is one in which the family has to have a more expensive wedding than the neighbors. And today, a great deal of the expensive weddings is destroying their actual integrity. I noticed in the paper some years ago of a little young woman in New York who committed suicide because her family could not afford to have a name band play at the wedding. Now, this type of thing is not just the result of one family's miserable attitude. It is the result of a way of life in which we are losing sight of value and going into a competition of pretensions, of trying to make things bigger and with no quality consideration of what they're worth. So when you get started on this, I always like to think that in weddings, and this is a policy which I've always used and made a point of, when the time comes for the ceremony, I like to remind the young people that I am performing a ceremony required by the state of California and also required to the ministry of those who have a church or ministerial wedding. I can marry them and unite them by the laws of the state, but I cannot unite them internally in the principles of marriage. I cannot justify or actually perform a wedding in which I unite their hearts and their souls. This they must do for themselves. And the wedding ring becomes a symbol of an eternal bondage, but not to slavery, but a bondage of love for each other. That's the highest form of relationship is simple, honest affection. That I can't bestow this in a wedding ceremony. I can't guarantee the result of the ceremony, but I can only perform that which makes possible their growth within themselves toward the goals of a union of spirit and heart for the common good. That these young people start out loving each other first and sacrificing a number of foolish things as a proof of sincerity. And the symbols of union are not valid unless these symbols are vitalized by conduct itself. So we always feel that it's necessary that the wedding ceremony not be considered an adequate beginning of marriage. It is not something that ensures a good marriage, but it may assist in producing one. It is not the answer to all needs. It does not then by legally permit the young people to do exactly as they please, break all the laws of God and nature, and remain responsible because they have a marriage license. This is not the purpose of marriage. Purpose of marriage is a sacrament. And a sacrament is a commitment in the presence of God. A commitment of self to the service of divine principles. It is in this particular case, it is the acceptance by the young people of the commandments of God concerning the conduct of marriage. It guarantees that they will be permitted to have the physical environment necessary for a good home. But the building of the home becomes a spiritual investment based in their own mutual investment of affection and regard. So we have in marriage only a physical thing unless it is a union of souls. Now in our day, unions of souls are a little difficult. First of all, many people don't even know they have a soul. And many of them manage to get through life without proving that they have one. But for the most part, the soul is there. And love is the easiest way of bringing this to the surface. But it has to be sincere. I think that the idea of the older generation of betrothal was very legitimate. I don't think an individual should meet someone on Tuesday and get the license on Friday. There should be time for thought, time for mediation and for consideration. There should be an opportunity to understand and know better exactly what is involved in a commitment. Also, there is a great deal of worry on matters of ulterior motive. But this can very often be discovered with a little timely thought. In the old days, there were very often what were called the marriage brokers. They were the ones that helped to select appropriate mates for various persons contemplating matrimony. The Chinese were very particular in having the ancestral pattern do the marriage brokerage work. And they had certain advantages in it that we have lost. It seems as though it's some way in this thing that before we have a final marriage, there should be some form of counseling. There should be some way of determining more of the compatibility of these people. that they should be they should understand their own backgrounds and what they have to give and what they will demand. The inexperienced, emotion-dominated person with no understanding of the responsibilities of life is in a poor position to make a good marriage, and that yet that is where most of them begin. Now, there are some who, regardless of anything you can do, cannot destroy that marriage. It is indestructible. There are a great many people who find in this sacrament a fulfillment of the highest hopes and aspirations of life. I remember not too long ago, I attended a party to celebrate the Diamond Jubilee of a couple that had been married for 60 years. And the two looking side by side looked like two beautiful figures from some classic work. They were young. They did not resemble each other very much. But at their age then, they were both in their 90s. The two looked almost exactly alike. They had grown together in every sense of the word. And while they were sitting like two bashful beaux in their teens, receiving the congratulation of three generations, I noticed that he put out his hand and squeezed hers without looking, but appearing very indifferent. But he was just bashful, that was all. But this type of thing happens. And where it happens, something very wonderful does happen. This is the type of marriage they can say was made in heaven. It is the type of thing that we all would long for and want to have. But more could come nearer to it if they would try. Because I have a great many people come to explain to me why they can't make it. And wanting my opinion and all counseling as to what they can do to may help to repair the situation. Most of the time the causes of trouble are very superficial. They simply represent a lack of unselfishness for even a moment. They require no sentiment or appeal for the sensitivity of each other. And I know that such cases can be very hard to work with, but nature sometimes steps in and gives very curious remedies to some of these things. A lady came to me many years ago who had an obstreperous husband. And of course, there are such things. This man would not allow his wife to learn to drive a car. She was married to him for over 40 years and never permitted to drive a car. Well, we did our best. I even saw him about a little bit about it also. But it looked as though it was hopeless. He belonged to some somewhat foreign background that was very stilted in these matters. But all of a sudden, without anybody having to do anything about it, heaven stepped in. The husband had a stroke. He wasn't badly incapacitated, but he could never get a driver's license again. So he had to let his wife learn to drive the car. Well, fate produces these very strange and unusual things sometimes. And they are obviously part of a large natural pattern. Nature has so endowed the individual that he has many aspects of his own nature. There are very few people who are not more or less compound in their potentials. They have a great many submerged assets and abilities and values that they don't ever release into manifestation. Under proper affectional relationships, these may be strengthened and more or less released. We will find that with affection, we can do things we never thought we could. And we can enjoy things we never thought or believed we would enjoy, simply because we were making happiness for someone we care for. And little by little, without too much interference, many of the complaints of young married couples can be arbitrated. But the world is very hard on these people. And it doesn't seem to be willing to make any considerations for them. The reason undoubtedly is simple. The legislators came mostly from unhappy homes themselves. They were part of a pattern of misunderstanding, misdirection, which they had accepted along with all who followed them. The world was following the wrong road. It was following a pathway that never had succeeded and never will. Now, up to a few years ago, there were some people, at least, who realized that the breaks that we are making never have succeeded. But in order to do that, you have to be literate. You have to be able to read a little history. You also have to get away from the television long enough to realize that that is not the custodian of integrities. But it is true that if a person studied a little the history of civilization, they would very soon come to understand the broad foundations of human relationship. They would know why nations rise and why they fall. They would know why rulers become tyrants or do not become tyrants. They know why religions pass through renovations and changes over periods of time. And they also realize the perpetual adjustment of the inner life to progress in the physical world. We are all adjusting constantly to the changes in our environment. And these changes are very desperate unless we have some solid core within ourselves. If we are living on the outside of ourselves, we do not have much luck trying to adjust to the outsides of the world. There has to be a solid core in every person, a core of basic conviction, a basic purpose, of dreams, of ideals, of reasons for existence. There must be some form of higher life within us, or we cannot cope with the problems of material existence. It doesn't mean we have to be great scholars or great thinkers. It only means that we have to have a certain kindliness toward values, toward realities. We have to maintain affections that sometimes we keep for a few years and then they fade away. We have to make them last for a lifetime if we want to cure this particular problem. So in order to get past the Chinese code, and that also which we find in early Christendom, we have to realize that the individual is really a spiritual being. This you have to get some way into your consciousness, that the individual is a spiritual being. The proof of this is rather obvious, however. You don't have to do anything very extraordinary to prove it. The mere fact that you are here proves it. You wouldn't be here at all unless you were alive. The only life in you is a divine life in you. That mysterious power which science has never been able to discover, that mysterious substance that makes us live, is something that is far deeper than daily existence. It is something that makes possible all of the experiences of living. It is the power of the thinker. It is the simple basis of affection. It is also health, and it is art and music, and everything that is important in life all arises from some deep source within ourselves. And this source is our divinity. And this divinity is the spark of God in ourselves. When we pervert life, we pervert the power of life. Every perversion that we make is directly a resentment of God, an unwillingness to accept the divine, a denial of the spiritual values of existence. As long as we keep on denying, we will cut off the strength of this internal resource, this resource that is there. And while it can be damaged and it can be so concealed that maybe for several embodiments it may not be able to function, but it is there ultimately and it will win. The individual, in spite of anything that he can do, think, or say, will ultimately outgrow his own weaknesses. But it's the hard way. Then we have to be punished constantly for our mistakes. To be punished for a mistake is not too bad, but to be punished constantly for the same mistakes and remedy them in no obvious way is simply lack of common sense. And life has a lot of common sense in it, but it's not in the curriculum at the present time. It's still waiting for inclusion. So the life within us demands something. The inner life demands more than we give. While the outer life is constantly compromising for pleasure or profit, the inner life is constantly asking for integrity. It is asking that the individual fulfill the inner values of his own character, that he becomes actually a person of worth. a person who is keeping the rules. Now, as we go through along the way of life, these rules become more and more difficult sometimes. But we must still try to keep them, because it is the way we live now that is going to determine not only the way we live somewhere later, but how the world is going to live with the children that we have brought into it. We have a duty to ourselves to grow, and we have a duty to help those who come after us to benefit from our growth, to understand what we can contribute to their unfoldment and their maturity. Again, I think there's so much to be said for Comenius, who was a very wonderful idealist, a Moravian clergyman, a contemporary of Bacon and Hartley and many of the interesting personalities of the 17th century. Comenius had a little book that he prepared for young students, and these students were taught the ABCs of life. And he had a book in which all these ABCs were represented by little moral images. And he was trying to teach all these young people to realize that their home was their security, that their parents were the visible expressions of the divine being, that their mothers and fathers were their greatest and truest friends and always would be. That these friends, because they loved them, would do everything possible to have the child grow up an upright, worthy citizen, capable of carrying his part of the world's load of responsibility. He also pointed out, even back in there, that there was no saying what was going to happen to these young people. They come into the world, they go to school, and they get an education, and they go out and do all kinds of things. But somewhere among these young people, who have had their first education at their mother's knee, must come the great executives, the leaders of policy, the lawyers, the physicians, all of those who are called more or less the leaders of culture, all the scientists, and biologists, and physicists, and astronomers, somewhere back in there were little ones at the mother's knee. Now, a great deal depended on what the mother did. And for the most part, I think in those days she did a generally better job than is being done now. There are some very devout ones now. Let us not mistake that for a moment. But there are too many to whom employment and progress in business comes first. Little by little, this wisdom of the mother is fading out in the new generation, and will not be available when these younger people, coming to maturity, take over the burden of running the world. They have not had the touch of grace. Many of them have not any strong religious beliefs, but they would have had something if in the parental life they had seen the sacrifice, charity, humility, dedication, devotion, and sincerity. These things coming to the child from the person closest to that child, and coming over a period of life in which the most sensitive parts of living are being molded. These basic teachers from the mother's knee are going to, and did, affect the history of the world. They were the great sources of strength. We are losing these sources of strength because of industrial or economic considerations. But somehow, something must be done to teach the child before it goes to school, to teach it in the home or in the family. And in the average family, if there was real cooperation, there could be a fairly solid little classroom for those who need particular training. If the parents are busy, there are the uncles and the aunts and the grandparents and the cousins and the nephews. There are many, and someone among them can help to bring up the children. And if privation or desolation comes, things can be done to make sure that these young people growing up are not going to be the dictators and agitators and destroyers of tomorrow. The aggressive, combative person is a product of something. And if we can remove what causes him, he will be, along with all others, a more useful and helpful and intelligent citizen. So we should all try, in any way we can, to support these things and find in the fulfillment of a better life that which is far more joyous than a fun generation supported by narcotics. We do not need fun. We need to enjoy the glories of a good life. We need to enjoy the privilege of seeing those who come after growing up among us. We have a right to see institutions created for human benefit, staffed by persons who believe in human benefit. We have a right to see that the world's work is done by people who have conscience, who have ideals, who have hopes, who have dreams like our own. And if this happens, we probably won't need very much armament, because armament is really prepared and maintained largely for those combative personalities who have been wounded in some way by the materialism of our present systems. So we have to try and find new ways to do these things. But each one in his own little life, in his own little way, can be a little more kind, a little more generous, a little more thoughtful, and in that way make a very important time. And on such holidays as Christmas and Easter, there should be a serious thoughtfulness as to our moral duty to each other and our spiritual duty to the deity from which we are descended. If we keep these thoughts carefully in mind, I think we will have a more valuable and permanently happy relationship with life. Thank you.